Category C3, magazine program, Moncrief.
David Reese loves pencils. He loves sharpening pencils. In fact, he's a full-time pencil sharpener and reckons he's the world's number one pencil sharpener, up number two pencils. Now he's written a book with the title, How to Sharpen Pencils. And David's on the line. Afternoon, David.
Hi, how are you?
Could you tell us where you first got your love of pencils from? Where did it all start?
Well, I grew up using pencils because I love to doodle and draw, you know, things like that. I used to be a cartoonist. And so, I spent my childhood using pencils and sharpening pencils, and then I rediscovered my love of sharpening pencils a couple years ago when I was working for the United States Census Bureau.
And was part of your job then, I assume part of your job then was to sharpen pencils?
Absolutely. In fact, it was the first thing that our staff instructor taught us to do was to sharpen the pencils in our census supply kits. And that's when I decided that I wanted to get paid to sharpen pencils.
And what was it about sharpening pencils that captured your imagination?
I think it was the physical satisfaction of the process of putting a really sharp point on a pencil, as well as the nostalgic satisfaction and the emotional satisfaction of doing it. This was during a crazy time in my life when I had quit cartooning and I didn't have any money and my marriage was falling apart and I didn't know what I was doing with my life. And in the middle of all that, just doing the simple act of sharpening pencils was really satisfying. So I decided to just pursue that activity as far as I could take it.
And when you were working for the Census Bureau, what was the method they showed you to sharpen the pencil?
We were all given supply kits on the first day of staff training, and inside the supply kits were some number two HB pencils for filling out the census forms, and then a tiny plastic single blade pocket sharpener, the type of sharpener that you twist the pencil inside and the little ribbon of shavings comes out. So that was one of the simplest techniques for sharpening a pencil, and it's the one that the government included with their census supply kits.
But now that you do this professionally, David, I assume that isn't, or maybe it isn't, the best method of sharpening a pencil.
Well, I have in my travel kit about 15 different pencil sharpeners. So I have all different types of techniques, each of which produces its own unique point and each of which produces its own kind of pencil shavings. And so depending on what the client wants, I can do anything from using one of those single blade pocket sharpeners to using a hand crank sharpener, either a single or a double burr hand crank sharpener, or a multi-hole multi-stage pocket sharpener, or just a straight blade like a pocket knife or a box cutter, not to mention graph paper and other finishing techniques that are available.
So there are different sorts of points on a pencil?
Oh, absolutely. Depending on what you want to use the pencil for, you can make all different types of points. You can make a stubby point, a long point, a tapered point, a flat point, a chisel point, a bullet point. They're all different types of points you can put on a pencil.
Because I suppose, yeah, if it's really, really sharp and you press too hard, you'll just snap it straight away.
Yeah, that's one of the most common complaints that I hear from people is, why is it that when I sharpen my pencil, as soon as I press it to the page, it snaps? And usually that's a result of over-sharpening. Using a sharpener too much, a sharpener that doesn't have an automatic stopping mechanism.
Do you ever use an electric sharpener, or is that cheating?
I do not.
What are the wrong ways to sharpen a pencil?
Using an electric pencil sharpener is getting started on the worst possible foot, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
There is the problem of over sharpening a pencil. There's the problem of putting an irregular pin tip on a pencil, which is another phenomenon that can lead to the pencil point shattering. Another common complaint that I hear from people is the pencil lead breaking off inside the sharpener. This is often a result of the pencil lead actually being broken inside the wooden shaft of the pencil without the user's knowledge. And there's all types of mistakes and errors and anxieties that can come with pencils. I just published a book about pencil sharpening called How to Sharpen Pencils. And one of the chapters in the book is psychological risks associated with different pencil sharpening techniques.
Can it be psychologically damaging?
Absolutely. If you get too invested in doing something like this, you run the risk of disappointment or self-loathing. It's just like any other physical process. An unsharpened pencil is a platonic ideal. It's perfect in its way. And when you decide to actually put a point on the pencil, that's when you run the risk of a less than perfect outcome. But it's an anxiety or a risk that we have to that we have to be willing to deal with if we want to use our pencils.
Well, yeah, if you want to use that risk of psychological damage on a daily basis if you're a regular pencil user.
Exactly. You understand what I'm getting at.
Yeah. But have you found, have you come across people who have been severely damaged by this?
Not severely psychologically damaged, fortunately. I mean, pencils at this point are inexpensive enough that there's always the option of just starting over again with a fresh tool. So it's not like a fine, you know, priceless heirloom or something where if you mess it up once, you're more or less out of luck. But still, I mean, people do get, it's remarkable to me throughout the life of this project and talking to people about my business and talking to people about my book, how many people do have anxieties or frustrations when it comes to sharpening a pencil.
But say if somebody gives you a lot of pencils to sharpen, might you have to sometimes say to them, well, these are pretty crappy pencils. They're sub-quality pencils.
Yeah, I mentioned that phenomenon in my book. I mean, you cannot expect a 4-star meal from a 1-star restaurant.
Mm.
So if you give me a pencil whose shaft is bowed or compromised, or whose pencil lead is off-center within the shaft, or, you know, the shaft, the wood or the graphite is of a poor quality, then the odds are I'll be able to put a decent-looking pencil point on it. But if you actually use the pencil, it probably won't be a satisfying experience.
Yeah, you're the world's number one, number two pencil sharpener. Why is a number two pencil your favorite?
Well, I just decided when I started my business that I would specialize on the most common form of pencil because it's the one that I'm have the most nostalgic associations with, and that's just the classic yellow number two HB pencil that American school children grow up using.
In your book also, you do have a section on wines that taste like pencils.
That's right.
What wines taste like pencils?
Oh, boy, I don't have the book in front of me, but one of the reasons that I decided to call my business artisanal pencil sharpening is because I live in the Hudson River Valley in New York State, and we have a lot of farmers markets and a lot of artisanal cheeses, and two of my friends in town own a wine shop called Artisan Wine Shop, which was a big inspiration for my business. So when I told my friends I was writing a book about pencils and I wanted to include a section on wines that taste like pencils, they agreed that I could bring them a huge Tupperware bin of pencil shavings. They would smell the shavings and then pull wines that they thought might capture some of those aromatics that we find in the graphite and the cedar of pencils. So it's mostly red wines, I can tell you that. You want to find a mineral-heavy red wine that tastes like a pencil because that'll be closer to the experience of actually liquefying and drinking a pencil, which is something I don't recommend doing.
No, indeed. No, but would you drink this wine while you're sharpening a pencil or while you're using your pencil?
I might drink this wine if I was sharpening pencil in a non-professional capacity, if I was at a party just kicking back and relaxing. But I am sober when I'm sharpening pencils for clients because I don't want to compromise my handiwork and I want to make sure that I can stay focused on the end result for my customers.
Because I assume pencils can be dangerous. They're pointed objects.
That's true. In fact, every pencil that I ship in its plastic display tube comes not only with the shavings, which have been bagged and labeled, but also a certificate. And on the certificate it says, a sharpened pencil is a dangerous object. Use with care.
You did mention, David, that when you first became involved with sharpening pencils, that, you know, your life was perhaps a bit unsteady, your marriage was falling apart. How are things for you now?
Things are better, although I'm feeling a lot of stress because I have over 75 pencils backed up in my workshop that I have to sharpen. So I'm afraid I've created a monster, although it's a relatively benign monster. The business has been more successful than I imagined.
How long does it take you to, because you say you've 75 backed up, how long does it take you to sharpen one pencil?
Well, I can do about 4 or 5 pencils an hour. And when I account for all my costs, I figure that when I'm sharpening pencils, I'm making about $40 an hour.
Right. Okay. So a lot of work to do. David's book is called, as he said, How to Sharpen Pencils, a Practical and Theoretical Treatise on the Artisanal Craft of Pencil Sharpening for Writers, Artists, Contractors, Flange Turners, Anglesmiths and Civil Servants. David Rees, thanks very much for talking to us. Talk.ie. Before the news, we were talking to David Rees about his book, How to Sharpen Pencils. Now, as we said in the course of that interview, he's the world's number one, number two pencil sharpener. Now, there is no official ranking on that. He wanted to point that out. He just gave himself that title just for a bit of fun. Texter says that the pencil guy's wife left him, go figure, says Gordon the van man. Somebody else reckons there's probably some sort of FOSS course in pencil sharpening. I'm a beer rep, and I always use pencils for work, much to the amusement of my customers. Pencils are class, Sean. As Blackadder said, life without love is like a broken pencil. Pointless, says Phil. That's beautiful. And Mick says, I'm always amazed at the lengths your research team go to make my day. Well, they do it just for you, Mick. They certainly don't do it for me. We'll move on to a more serious topic, because in many parts of the world, it is normal practice for male babies to be circumcised. But is this really necessary? Does it do more harm than good and give the child no say in the matter? Is that fair? Glenn Callender thinks not. He's the founder of the Canadian Foreskin Awareness Project, and he's on the line. Good afternoon, Glenn.
Good afternoon.
As I understand it, leaving aside groups such as Muslims and Jews, for instance, but it's quite common in North America for kids to be circumcised anyway. As I understand, that's because some people think it's more hygienic to do that.
Yes, and that is a completely absurd argument. And you'll hear that all the time from parents in North America, that it'll be easier for the boy to keep his penis clean if we cut off the foreskin. But that's crazy. The penis is not difficult to clean. I'm sure your audience is well aware that the foreskin is very easy to clean. It is simply really a superstition more than anything else, just a belief that the natural penis must be dirtier than a circumcised one, because more penis must mean dirtier penis.
By being circumcised, is that male, and you know this happens to them when they're a child, when they grow up to be an adult, what have they lost? Other than a little bit of skin, but other aspects of their life that they've lost?
Well, they've actually lost a lot of skin. The foreskin in an adult is in the neighborhood of 15 square inches of sensitive tissue. Circumcision removes well over half the nerves of the penis and the most sensitive parts of the penis. So it makes a very big difference to a man's sexual experience. Again, there's a myth over here in North America that circumcision does not affect a man's sexual experience, but it's completely absurd to say that you can cut off a large part of a man's penis and not take a large part of his sexual pleasure with it.
Have any tests been done that? I suppose it's hard to compare like with like, unless, you know, you got somebody to voluntarily cut off their foreskin to compare.
I know several men who were talked into circumcisions as adults by doctors and said, I had no idea how much sensitivity I would lose. It's absolutely profound. But the bottom line is that it's very easy to understand just by the basis of the fact that there are tens of thousands of nerve endings in the foreskin. If you cut off those nerves, those nerve endings are dead, and you will not have sensation anymore, right? Mm. I mean, you don't have to pluck out one of your eyes to know that your vision will not be as good without both of your eyes. So really, there isn't really a contest here. Circumcision was originally devised in the English-speaking world by Victorian doctors specifically to prevent boys from masturbating and to prevent grown men from going to prostitutes and committing adultery. The rationale was 100% to reduce sexual pleasure, and that went out of style. So now every generation or two, the circumcisers promote new quote-unquote health benefits to justify continuing to do circumcisions. But the reality, of course, is that there are no bad parts of the penis. The natural human body works perfectly well without surgical intervention, and boys have a basic human right to decide for themselves if they don't want some of their sex organs.
And you'd imagine that the foreskin is there for a purpose anyway.
Absolutely. The foreskin is not a mistake. Every male and female mammal has a foreskin and has for over 650 million years. It's a fundamental part of the mammalian anatomy, and it is an important part of sex. It not only protects the mucus, the foreskin not only protects the mucous membranes of the penis, but it is also a stimulator of both the penis and the vagina. And it has a major role to play in sex. When it is removed, a man loses a significant amount of experience, and his partner loses experience too, because, like I said, the foreskin is actually also a stimulating mechanism. It's a pleasure organ.
So if the medical reason for circumcision is somewhat dubious, then would you see it as a kind of a human rights issue? Because obviously to take this very important piece of tissue from a male child without their permission does violate their human rights.
Absolutely. It absolutely violates human rights. And we practice a purely sexist double standard right now in North America.
where the genitals of a girl are protected, absolutely, until she's 18 years old. You can't even take a needle and put a tiny pinprick in the genitals of a girl. Without, you know, if you do that, you can go to prison for 14 or 15 years for aggravated sexual assault. Mm. On the other hand, you can cut off a very large part of a boy's penis. You can throw a party. So there's a real difference there in how male and female genitals are regarded, respected, and protected in law. And in Canada, we have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms that guarantees equal protection under the law. And that means that a girl has a right to keep all of her sex organs and decide for herself if any of them get cut off. Then a boy has that right too, and so does an intersex child. We should not be in the business of looking at the bodies of our children and saying, oh, they don't need those extremely sensitive and enjoyable sex organs. That is a real crime against a person's sexuality and their life. Because, you know, when you lose part of your body, you do lose part of your life. You lose all of the experiences you would have had with that body part.
Mm.
And the foreskin has very, very good experiences. So I don't believe we have the right to take that away from someone else. As a man with a foreskin, I think I'm very angry to know that when I was born, my mother was badgered in the hospital by the staff because they wanted to cut off my foreskin. And that fills me with rage, frankly, because I love my foreskin. And the thought that someone thought they had the right to do that to me makes me very, very angry. And that's one of the reasons why I'm an activist.
And your activist group is, you said, the Canadian Foreskin Awareness Project. And, you know, you are touring North America. Now, as part of that, Glenn, you use your own penis.
Absolutely, yes. I do a show that's very much like Puppetry of the Penis, except it's educational and political.
Mm. And what exactly do you do with your penis to kind of, is it to demonstrate the benefits of having a foreskin?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I do some tricks with my foreskin to get their attention so that they realize the foreskin is a very large part of the penis.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I talk about the anatomy and function of the foreskin, the harm of circumcision, and the human right of boys to enjoy all of their penis. The show is it's about 20 minutes long, and it gets a hell of a response from the audience. I do it in a small tent, 10 feet by 10 feet, or 3 meters by 3 meters, I guess, for you guys. I can pack about 25 people in there at once, and I do my show, and it really blows their minds because it's not like anything they've ever seen before.
I would imagine not. But given this, you're talking about, well, you know, many people would regard as perhaps quite a serious issue. You know, going around showing people your penis might trivialize it.
Oh, absolutely not. When people see my show, they realize that this is a really legitimate issue. The reason why circumcision is becoming a major issue now, I think, is because Western societies have evolved to the point where we can talk about human genitalia in sufficient detail for people to understand the benefits of foreskin and the harm of circumcision. In past decades, you really couldn't talk about this without causing too much discomfort. But nowadays, people can understand it. And with my show using humor and some showmanship, I make people very comfortable with the fact that they are sitting in a tent with a man waving his penis around. And they learn a lot of things about the foreskin that they didn't know previously. Right? Mm. When I went through sex education in the 80s here in Canada, there was no foreskin on the diagram of the penis that we studied.
Huh.
And even now, you can pick up books about sexuality published in the USA and Canada and still see the foreskin either missing from the diagram of the penis or present but not labeled or discussed. And that's absolutely crazy, because the foreskin is where most of the nerves of the penis are, and it's also where the most sensitive and orgasmic parts of the penis are. And nobody is really aware of this, and so when people see my show, they learn a whole bunch of stuff about the foreskin they never knew, and they find that very, very surprising.
Glenn, to bring about a change in this, obviously a political change might be necessary, but I assume you'd need to change the minds of people in the medical profession as well.
Well, first of all, you might hear claims about the health benefits of circumcision in the press, but no national medical association in the world believes there's a medical reason to cut a healthy boy. These, you know, panels of experts have examined the claims of health benefits, and they've concluded worldwide that the harm of circumcision does not outweigh the, you know, the alleged benefits of circumcision. So the bottom line here is that the medical communities in the world do not recommend circumcision. The practitioners who actually cut children will tell you all sorts of things about the wonders that their surgery will do for a boy's life, but medical associations do not believe that.
Glenn, thank you very much for talking to us. That was Glenn Callender there, founder of the Canadian Foreskin Awareness Project. Glenn, thanks a million.
News Talk 106 to 108.